CataractCoach.com podcast series, episode number 46, with Dr. Shiraz Dia, encouraging entrepreneurship in ophthalmology. Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast, today with Dr. Shiraz Dia from London. Shiraz has an incredible center there called Center for Sight, and he'll tell us all about that, but he has a very interesting journey in ophthalmology, including a large stint in the USA. So Shiraz, welcome to our podcast.
Great. Thank you, Udin. I feel very honored and privileged to be selected to be on your podcast.
It's my way of saying thank you. I've learned so much from you over the years. You're, you know, a brilliant ophthalmologist, absolutely brilliant.
Oh, you say that to all the boys.
No. But tell us about your path in ophthalmology, because it's a little bit of a circuitous path involving a couple of multiple countries.
It is. You know, I'm of Indian origin, from East Africa. I'm an East African Asian. Grew up in Tanzania, born in Kenya, grew up in Tanzania. Went to school in India, in South India, in very early days, between the ages of 10 and 15. A kind of a brutal place up in the Nilgiri Hills, which are more like mountains, 8,000 feet above sea level. And then I came to the UK and went to high school here and went to medical school in Dublin, qualified there. And then I went to Belfast, Northern Ireland, right in the midst of the Troubles in 1984, right on the Falls Road for a year, by choice. I learned a lot about people then. I'm not going to comment too much. We could do that over a beer sometime. But then I went to New York after that, and I couldn't get into ophthalmology. This is 1985.
Sure.
I did internal medicine, and I finished in 1988.
You did a full three-year internal medicine residency.
Yeah, I'm board-certified in internal medicine.
So when you're on the airplane and they say, is there a doctor on board, you can do more than me. I can only check the pupils.
I pick up the newspaper and I cover my head.
Well, so you did a three-year internal medicine residency and fully qualified as a primary care doctor.
That's right. I worked in the emergency rooms, moonlighted in emergency rooms. I got into ophthalmology straight after. I did the boards while I was in ophthalmology residency. And it helped supplement my income on the weekends. Every so often, do a 12-hour shift at New York downtown or Beekman Hospital. And eventually that really wasted me. I had to stop doing that, especially when the chairman found out. He said, well, you got to make a choice. You've chosen ophthalmology, you better just stick to it. And so I did. I did residency in ophthalmology in New York at a place called, at a two-bit center called Catholic Medical Center. And it was David Payton of Project Orbis fame, King Khaled Eye Specialty Hospital and the Cullen Eye Institute. And, you know, the son of Townley Payton, the person who set up the first eye bank in the USA. So he was my mentor and my chairman at the time. And what a great inspiration to have as a mentor. And, you know, everything was possible. He could turn people into gold. He had this touch. And I'm very grateful that he found me and brought me in and I had the opportunity to become an ophthalmology resident. And after that, I went into the fellowship in Minneapolis with Dick Lindstrom and Ed Holland. So mainly under Ed Holland, wow. Dick Lindstrom had gone into private practice. So we spent 6 months on each side.
And that was fantastic.
I mean, it was really amazing. I was exposed to several individuals. So it was Ed Holland, Dick Lindstrom, Steve Lane. I can't remember the names, Don Doofman, and who else was there? There were a couple of others, but they all had the different
superstars.
So yeah, they were. It was fantastic, and I could take the best out of each one of them. What I aligned with me personally, and that variety was in 1 year. I absorbed a huge amount. I also had the opportunity because they had a who's who for grand rounds. And although I had to cover the residence as a fellow, I used to sneak into grand rounds there and hear all these big names, you know, who's who in ophthalmology in the United States, come and talk for 2 or 3 hours. And I was like a sponge. I just soaked it all in. It didn't matter if it was neuro-ophthalmology or retina or uveitis. Although I was a cornea fellow, the information was fantastic and the exposure to those individuals was great. So that brain power, that knowledge base in the United States, it was what a privilege to have. I would do it all over again in a flash.
Wow, it sounds an amazing experience. But yeah, you're right. At the young ages, even I remember back, Like, I was so enthralled with learning about anything ophthalmology. Like, retina, the fun of the excitement of learning was wow.
That's great. And you know, especially when you've been to a sort of community residency program where it's kind of mediocre, everything's mediocre, and then you come to a level of excellence, which is kind of what I always aspired to do. I always wanted to be, mediocrity, as David Payton used to say, be like, Shiraz, mediocrity should never be in your vocabulary. Anything you do, you need to do the best of your ability and surround yourself with really good people. And I'm sorry I can't provide them that here at the Catholic Medical Center, but as you go through life, just do that. Just surround yourself with these superstars, and it'll transfer across. So always think, strive for the heights. And that was always stuck with me. So going to Minneapolis was fantastic. Just get that exposure. All those, the who's who. Amazing. And as you say,
good.
Anything to do with ophthalmology was great, and seeing to even now.
So sure.
I feel very fortunate and blessed to have had all those opportunities, traveling to different countries and getting exposure. So after I finished ophthalmology, I decided to look for a job in the United States. I went to Albuquerque, to the University of New Mexico.
Wow.
I went to private practices in Connecticut and other university places. And I just didn't feel I could work for anybody else. So David Payton basically gave me his practice. He got kind of run out of town by the establishment at the Catholic Medical Center. So I took over his practice, and I did a lot of cornea very, very quickly because he had a huge cornea practice.
Sure.
And I got off to a flying start. But then, after a year and a half of being in practice in New York, it was on Madison Avenue in Queens and in Brooklyn, and I taught residents as well. I came to the United States to get an education, and I just wake up in the morning. I wasn't married. I was single. I used to wake up on a Saturday and Sunday. And what am I doing here? What am I? When you wake up in the morning and then you just don't know what you're going to expect when you go back to work the following week. Something's got to change. And that's when I thought, maybe I should think about going back to Europe. And then it's amazing. You plant a seed, and sometimes the universe goes ahead and presents you with opportunities. So I was looking to go to Spain, but it was like, where can I go? It's good weather, and it's a little bit behind. And Spain, I went to the. I was trying to get an ophthalmic department at the hospital of Costa del Sol, and we were making good progress. But they wanted me to set up the emergency department as well, since I've done emergency medicine. And I thought, I'm an ophthalmologist, guys. I can help you with that, but I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to run it.
You tell them I want to do corneas, not coronaries.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. And anyway, so it's kind of long story short. A job came up in the UK, and it was Tom Casey, who is a well-known corneal surgeon internationally. He wrote a book on corneal grafting, and he was at this place called East Grinstead, quite well known. And they were looking for a corneal person. I thought, my brother found the advertisement in the British. It was in the wrong place. It was under plastic surgery instead of, because they called it the corneoplastic unit, and it was under plastic surgery as opposed to ophthalmology. And my brother's is an ENT surgeon, so otolaryngology, and straight after otolaryngology was plastics. And he went to the thing, he said, this is in the wrong place. But gosh, this sounds like what my brother's doing in New York. Maybe I should send it to him. So he sent the advertisement, and he called up the region, and he said, would you take my brother? He's a corneal specialist in New York, and he's GMC registered. He's trained in Ireland. I said, yeah, we'd love to meet him. By coincidence, I was going to the UK that weekend to see my mother, who was visiting from Tanzania. And I went to the plane arrived in Gatwick, and it's only a 10 minute drive from Gatwick. So I went to the place, and it was an absolute dump. And there's a guy called Steve Whiffen, who I owe a lot to. He was a locum. He was a fellow of Tom Casey's, and he was working as a locum consultant in that department, doing the transplants and looking after all these patients. Mm-hmm. And he convinced me to take the job, and he wanted to come to the United States to train in cornea. And he was trying to do a swap. So he went to Minnesota, but he went to the Mayo Clinic. And with Bill Bourne and others. And I came to East Grinstead. And that's how I got started in the UK. And I have not looked back.
Well, see, it's funny. I think everyone I've spoken to, and me included, everything in life is about good mentors, and that's just about serendipity, just about luck.
And I think
sometimes things just happen.
And I think there's a magical ingredient, and that's your own what you're aspiring to do yourself, right? What your own is. What are you looking for yourself and being true to yourself? Then I think then you recognize those opportunities. So it may be serendipity, but it may not be too. There's something at work there.
And a little hidden kismet.
Yeah, it's a little bit, you know, call it charm, call it whatever you want, but there's something there. There's some energy there that's connecting. And I truly believe that. And I've always found that sometimes there's decisions, you know, things are really difficult. It's probably not the direction you're supposed to go in, right? And when it comes really naturally, you just flow.
You're drawn to it, right?
So when I was coming to the UK, there was only one person who thought it was a good idea, and that was David Payton. Everybody else thought it was a crazy idea. I was going back in time. It was a ridiculous idea. My cousins, my uncles, cousins of mine left the UK and arrived in the United States, Anistis and others. I said, "What are you doing going back to the UK? It's a disaster." I just felt instinctively it was going to be fine, and the demographics were right, the place was right, and I did it. It was very.
It all works out.
As I say, if for anybody listening, you know, sometimes if just go with the flow. If things are really straightforward, yeah, maybe that's the journey you're supposed to be taking.
That's a great point. Now, when did you set up Center for Sight? It must be almost 30 years now.
It's 27 years. So wow. I'll be in the UK 30 years on March 1st. So I arrived at Gatwick Airport on 1st of March, and I went straight into work from the airport. Everybody thought I was crazy. I set up a private practice as myself in July that year. And then I started working for a laser center, and I was a medical director. And, you know, it's, in Britain, it's a little bit different. Well, in those days, it was very different from the United States, where it was all about the doctor. They were kings. They were gods. I mean, you talk to a patient, they go, "Well, you're the doctor. You're the expert. You tell me what I got to do." They go, wait a minute. That's not the way it works. It's kind of a shared thing here. I talk to you. It's not because I don't know what I'm talking about. I'm talking to you because you have to make a choice. It's your body. It's your eyes. Anyway, it was different. But the way in which the patients were looked after in terms of refractive surgery was terrible. And I thought the only way to do it is to set up my own center. So I bought a laser. There's a company called LaserSight. It's an absolute disaster. But again, serendipity. So I bought a LaserSight laser. They were chasing me at the end of the quarter in 1996 to buy one of their lasers. And I was in the Ruaha Reserve in Tanzania. And they were trying to contact me by satellite phone before New Year's Eve. And I just gave them a price and they said, "Fine." And I said, "Okay, well, when I get back to Dar es Salaam, I'll sign the papers." And they were there, they'd been faxed over. I signed them and they shipped out the laser on the 2nd of January. And it arrived. Wow. I didn't even have a place for it. So, oh God, you know, here I go. Now I have to set up a laser center. It's all been shipped and I have to pay them for it. Anyway, it took me about 4 months to get 5 months to get started, and I did. And the laser was a dog. The company were terrible. They sent me an old laser that was behind the times. It was an old model, and my wife Marcella came to help us get started. And she couldn't believe that they sold me this laser that was a piece of junk. Anyway, they changed it, and then they had to change it again, and then they finally gave me an LSX. We made a deal. And that came in broken, and just, I mean, you could tell. Finally, so that was a year and a half later, and Marcella, I had already asked her to marry me, and so we got married, and she said, "Look, dump LaserSight, bad company, bad people, just dump them."
And so, well, we should add that your wife Marcella is an ophthalmologist as well.
She is, yes. She trained with Arturo Chayet in Mexico, and. She's been a great supporter, and I'm very.
So she tells you to dump LaserSight.
Dump LaserSight, and I already had a relationship with Bausch & Lomb, so we bought a Bausch & Lomb laser, now I'm the medical monitor for Bausch & Lomb lasers, and Technovas in Germany. So I deal with all the issues when it comes to, you know, new developments and so on for the eczema laser and also for the femtosecond laser as well. So it's crazy how it all goes. And yeah, you know, four lasers later, and I met my wife's laser sight. So even though it was not a good experience, I learned one thing though. And it's, you know, when you do business with anybody, you got to give them your money. Just make sure that the kind of individuals that you would have home for dinner.
Oh, I like that.
If they're not, you know, they got to be good people, right? They got to be clean. Right. They got to have integrity. And if that's not the case, think twice. You know, make you look for an alternative, because I think that's really important. And I've again lived by that rule ever since. Although I'm very thankful that I met my wife through laser sight, and life has been good as a result. But yes,
that's incredible advice. So I love that. Make sure it's someone you'll have at your house for dinner. Another one I heard was, if you decide to go into business with someone as a partnership, ask yourself, would you want to go on a family vacation with that person? Bring that person and their family with you and go on a family vacation together. I was like, whoa, that's a great question.
That's a step forward. Dinner's a, you know, is one thing, but vacation, yeah, that could be quite dramatic.
And then now you've grown Center for Sight incredibly. Like you're now multiple locations. You're incredibly busy. It's, wow, been an incredible success for you.
Yeah, it's been good. But it's been organic. And so we have two surgical sites. And we also have it's a satellite that's in London, based in London, for the international side of things and for the, you know, for convenience for patients. But I operate out in the countryside. We have a site right in our village where we live in Surrey, a place called Oxshott. It's where Chelsea Football Club live. Training grounds are just 3 miles down the road. But I hasten to add, I moved here before they did.
Well, so if they miss a goal, I can only assume it's because of their eyesight. You didn't do a good job.
I think somebody else deals with their side of things. Okay. Their eyesight. And the other place is in East Grinstead. So I thought I was going to stay in the health service. So I built an eye hospital in East Grinstead. The way it goes, a year later, I had a fallout with the chief executive who wanted to try and micromanage me. And my parents couldn't micromanage me. That's where they sent me off to boarding school.
And I was going to say, I had a suspicion.
At the age of 50, I have a chief executive trying to micromanage me. And it's not going to work, is it? So I thought, right, you know what? I'd go on a sabbatical. And if he was still going to be there after I came back, then I was going to resign. And he was, so I left. That was great because I was working really hard, running a department, right, building it, doing research, doing basic science, right, stuff, stem cells, trying to build Center for Sight, growing that side of the business, traveling like everybody else. A big chunk got cut out. And I think I will live longer as a result of that. So again, I did my time and I am now where I am. And it's a good place. I'm very pleased with where things are. We do want to grow further. What I did was set up a very American-like practice where, you know, we've got technicians and support, and an ophthalmologist does the work of an ophthalmologist, which is to see patients, diagnose, and do surgery, as opposed to the trivial pursuits. Now, that doesn't happen in the UK. A lot of my colleagues...
Oh, really?
We'll do, they take the visions, do the pressures, do the IL master, do the pentacams and so on. It's a waste of time. But it's kind they need to put their hands in their pockets and spend a bit of money and increase their volume of practice.
Right.
Support. And then I think there are groups now learning that. But we were kind of early in getting started. And I know us, but I think there are many that have told me that we've inspired them to do the same. And I cheer them on. I think there's a big vacuum there for ophthalmologist-run practices. And every time I hear of a new one, I cheer them on. I think it's great. I don't see them as competitors or even rivals. I think this is our fantastic.
They're brothers and sisters. They're colleagues, of course.
Exactly. And it's, you know, anything we can do to help them get on their journey, well, why not? I feel the duty to do so since I've had the privilege of learning how. The alternative is big corporations, you know, cherry picking, and we have those too. And actually, unfortunately, they do harm the industry. And it makes it much more of a battle for us. The 800-pound gorillas that are out there, they know who they are. And it's a problem. But anyway, there's room for everybody.
Right. Well, I think doctors should be the captains of the healthcare ship. And I long for the days when we have just the doctors running the show, as opposed to now the business types who come in and think that the doctors are just employees. So I think that's a great, valid point there.
Well, now it's very telling, isn't it? There's a shortage of doctors in the United States and in Europe and everywhere in the world. There's going to be shortages of doctors. Well, you know, the doctors are going to wind up being in that privileged position again. But they should embrace it and right. learn to maintain their leadership position. Now, not every doctor can be a leader, as you know. There are some that want to be leaders and should be leaders, and there are others that don't want to be leaders, and they just want to come and do their work, get great pleasure out of looking after patients. And you know, they need to figure it out for themselves. But doctors really should lead. I'm totally with you on that one. And they should be encouraged to do so, and they should muscle in, if they can, on leadership right. positions. Otherwise, yeah. they pay the price of being pushed around, Man. Becoming dependent on systems and organizations that are not working in their best interests, and they go home not feeling accomplished.
Right. Well, I think we're seeing that in the U.S. now. A lot of younger doctors are doing combined MD degree as well as MBA degree, Master of Business Administration. So they're doing combined MD-MBA degrees, yep. which I think is a great move for the future because, let's face it, you go back to secondary school or even university, the smartest kids in the room were not the business types. They were the ones who were doing medicine.
No, that's right. And it is interesting that in medical school, there's a lot we don't learn. Right. And it is great to see those MBA programs and also other ventures like Francesco Coronas and Amanda Coronas I've got a new conference in March, and I'm going to plug it a little bit if you don't mind.
I'm for sure.
Advising committee. It's called Orthopreneurs. It's a great name, and it's to do with the business of ophthalmology, not just how you run your practice and all the rest of it, but right down to investment. If you've got a startup, you've got some ideas. Right. It's the whole business of ophthalmology. But
tell me more about the meeting. I'll put a link down below for our viewers and our listeners so you can check it out. So we're going to have this podcast hosted or aired in February, so it'll be the following month, March. Where's the conference going to be?
It's going to be in Stresa in Italy. It's a bit north of Milan. Very nice place. And it's on from, I think it's the 17th of March.
We'll put a link down below.
Yeah. And there's going to be a lot of well-known doctors. It's mainly a European meeting, but there's some U.S. representation as well. And it's going to be they're going to have experts in their own fields, not right. doctors. So when it comes to finance, there'll be people who understand money and understand how to convey that information. When it comes to marketing and dealing with social media, the experts there, the expertise in all different areas, and it's going to be quite a different sort of meeting, a bit like ACOS Europe. I don't know if you've ever attended the ACOS Europe meeting.
I was just there, sure.
A lot more discussion, a lot more
interaction
and informal and very collegial. So it's interesting. It's our first conference, and I'm certainly looking forward to it. And
awesome. Well, I won't be able to make it this year, but I'll put it on my calendar for 2025.
No, it's good. I think we're grateful to have you. We'll have you chip in there and your perspectives.
Well, there's one important thing you said too earlier, which is like the American style, let's say, of practice, which is, I agree with you. I try to delegate as much as possible. Mm-hmm. I want to do the things that only I can do. Like I can answer the phone. I can run a biometry test on the eye. But there's no one else in the entire clinic who can do the actual surgery. No, so I should focus on what I do, which is surgical decision-making, the new patient consult, and doing the surgery.
That's right. And you know what? When you have technicians who do all those investigations day in, day out, they get much, much better doing it than anybody else.
Right.
So that bandwidth of error goes down tremendously. So you can start to rely heavily on their abilities. And why not? They're good at it. So everybody has a role to play. In delivering what we want, which is fantastic outcomes for patients. Making sure our bandwidth of error, lens calculations or refractive errors that we're choosing to correct are down to a fine limit. And,
right.
and I, You know, I mean, we always know when a new technician arrives, you know, I'm on guard and I've got to take a look at the data to make sure it's actually accurate and that's within the signal to noise ratio is appropriate. Right. But yeah, they should, you know, they do it all the time. They can very, very good, very adept at it, way better than I could ever do it.
Right. And then you want to build up that working relationship over the course of years, the trust you have there is immense.
Yeah, that's right. And yeah, it's all teamwork, isn't it? It's all about working together. And the same in the OR as well. I do what I have to do as a surgeon, but I don't want to deal with all the other things. Everything else is organized for me. All the planning is done in advance. And again, I learned all this under Ed Holland and Dick Lindstrom and seeing those high volume organizations. And I realized that they have a peaceful life. They're pretty content. They don't have to worry about all the hassles. It's all sorted out for them. It may seem expensive. As I tell colleagues in the UK, they come to visit me and they see all the people around us supporting us. So yeah, it looks expensive, but you know what? It's better for me. As I'm going to live a little life and much more accomplished. I'm doing what I am trained to do. Why should I follow the trivial pursuits? I don't want to do them.
I'm with you 100%. I delegate as much as possible. And I find true pleasure and true enjoyment in doing the surgery. Mm-hmm. But I'll tell you now, if it comes to doing a LASIK, don't trust my refraction. Trust my optometrist.
Yes,
sir. He's far better at it than me.
That's right. And they do it all the time. And they understand what's important. And they also see the patients afterwards. And so they know they get the feedback. You know, was that my refraction? That error, was that me or is that this? Did he plug in the wrong correction?
Right.
But yeah, you're right. Might as well use people who have their own level of expertise well to support what we all do.
Wow, fantastic. Now, so you've built this incredible center. You're doing a ton of surgery. You're enjoying your life. You and your wife are obviously very busy surgically. What's next for you? What's next on the agenda?
Well, we have that's interesting you ask. I mean, I was trying to figure out what to do there myself. But one of the things I need to do is to do some planning for this organization. I'm in my 60s. I'll be 64 in a few weeks' time.
And well, you look much younger than me. My gosh, you look amazing.
Well, it must be KISS keeping me young, you know? I'm very proud of our son and our daughter, Olivia. Is both of them, Olivia and Fernando, they're both going to qualify as doctors this year.
Oh, fantastic.
I hope they stay in medicine. But anyway, it's a long haul over here, but I'm very, very proud of them. So,
well, I hope they choose ophthalmology instead of orthopedics.
Well, my wife says, Marcella says that she will ensure they do that. kids, I don't know about you, but kids don't listen to their dads. They do listen to their mother. So I leave it to the mom to sort out. So that's great, but I have myself and a retina colleague, a friend, Tom Williamson, have set up a startup, and we call ourselves Infinite Medical Ventures. And take innovation and from anybody and try and help them move it forward. Because the number of people that have ideas, good ideas that just go nowhere. They go through the IP process. They spend huge amounts of money and then they come to a standstill or they don't have the resources, whatever. Now we didn't either, but we had our own ideas, and we developed something that we're hoping to commercialize with the assistance of a strategic. But it's been a very steep learning curve, but it's been a huge amount of fun, and I think with 30 something years of experience in ophthalmology, it's time to make use of that,
leverage it. Sure.
So between a retina guy and an anterior segment guy working together, we've actually done all this on our own steam, our own cash. It's now time to get some funding from others. But what we want to do is more of the innovation side, not deal with the hassles of quality management and all the awful things that you have to deal with as a manufacturer. I'd rather somebody else deal with all that. And I could spend time dealing with new ventures and a pipeline of future products. So we're learning the business. It's been a very steep learning curve, but we actually have a product that could be used both in the clinic and also in surgery. And it's going to be a bit of a disruptor, because it's going to take existing technologies and undercut them tremendously, which I think is making some of the strategics a bit nervous. But we'll see how it goes. We spent quite a lot of cash on it, and it's great to see the development take shape and actually work.
So I think it's important to be able to switch gears every so often in your career. Like you were saying, when you were 50 years old, you had some issue with some hospital. You say, you know what? Take a sabbatical. Oh, still not working out. You know what? I wish you well. Let me do my own thing. I did the same thing. At 52, I actually stopped doing university professor duties. I stopped teaching residents. So I was doing half my week in private practice and then half my week in university. And I stopped all my UCLA resident teaching activities. And thought, you know, it's time to switch gears. It's time to do something different.
Yeah, and I think it's very important for us to pave the way for others to come in too. And to bring them along. There is this old empire mentality, certainly in a lot of Commonwealth countries and in the UK and in Europe, where the boss wants to be the boss forever, right? That doesn't happen as much in the United States. And I think a lot of it reflects how the government runs. You know, you've got two terms and then you're out, right? And the same happens with societies and others. I mean, we've got the ESCRS, we've got these chair people that have been there for decades. They don't leave their positions.
Right.
And I keep saying, we've got a responsibility to make sure that we vacate the chair and let others in. And we should be looking for other things to do. It's a great shame if you're still doing the same thing you're doing now as you did 30 years ago, right?
I think you're right. You have to pass the baton. For me, I always thought, I don't want to be some 75-year-old professor teaching the same thing for the last 40 years. It doesn't make any sense. So when I was 52, I said, you know, I've done it for 22 years. I did it from the age of 30 to 52. And I said, I need to pass the baton. We need to get someone here who has no gray hair. Let him or her take over. They'll figure it out, and I'll pass the baton. And I think that was one of the best things I ever did.
No, it's good. I think that's and then you probably found other things to do, right?
Oh my goodness!
Cataract
as a gadget.
It's amazing. Those videos that you put together. You know, I sit there, watch them. I go, wow! You know, there's something to learn every single time. Not necessarily everything that you point out in those videos. You know, I will see other things going on and go, wait a minute, that's a neat way of doing that. It's phenomenal. But what a great thing that you've done there. I mean, those videos. I know how long it takes to make a video. It's very time consuming.
I put a new one up every day for more than 2,000 days in a row.
You know, I've got 100 terabytes of data right here of video.
Send me one. I'll edit it for you.
I know. Maybe I should do that. There's just sitting here, and I every so often I get Lucio Barato giving me a hard time about sending him a video. I go, and I wish I kind of forget what I did, but I've got some real sweet ones that I really need to find time to put together. I'm hoping my son will get interested in editing them for me.
For sure.
But
after we air your podcast, the day after, we'll feature one of your videos. So just remember, sometime the next week, send me a video of anything surgical. I'll edit it. I'll do the voiceover. Just send me the raw footage. Something interesting.
Let me take a look at that. Or I might send you something that I've already edited, and you can put that up.
But like you, in fact, I have got a lot of projects in the ophthalmology space. I could make use of your new company to help get this from idea or even intellectual property to the next phase. So I'm already involved in multiple things.
Yeah. Well, we should talk. I mean, I'm not saying I'm an expert. You know,
neither am I.
Has been so steep, but there's nobody that you can go to really learn from unless you've actually been in the process, unless you've worked for these companies. It's kind of hard to give up the day job too. You know, so I suppose as I learn, and as we learn, Tom and myself, we again following on from the point we made earlier on about passing on the baton, and involving successes. It'll be our duty to make sure we make this an established part of what we do in this microcosm, where Yeah, ophthalmologists can be enterprising and can be involved in these sort of ventures and develop new tech. There's no reason why they shouldn't be. In fact, what a great place to be. You've got the knowledge of ophthalmology. You've got the experience in ophthalmology. You know what people want, and you know what you want. Mm-hmm. And then you've got this the wherewithal to be able to make it happen, too. And I think that that combination is fantastic, but we've got to put it together. So collectively, I'm sure that we can make the future change quite considerably. And it's changing anyway. I think it's going to be forced on us with artificial intelligence and augmented reality and simulation and all the rest of it. It's changing without we can't stop it. It's going to keep happening.
For sure. Yeah, like let's say the only constant. And ophthalmology is change.
No, that's right. That's right. Even the eye changes, and that's where we make up. That's where we get our business, right?
With the aging eye, absolutely. Yeah, of course, the aging eye. But I think there's so many I'm always impressed when I go to any ophthalmology meeting. Most of the time, 99% of the time, I'm sure I'm the dumbest person in the room. There are so many incredibly brilliant people in ophthalmology, but a lot of times they have a brilliant idea that really has never gone to fruition because they're kind of lacking this, okay, what the idea of what do I do next and lacking the support of getting along down the road a little bit more.
That's right. And some industry, the sharp individuals may well pick up on it and help it through. But so much of the time they're kind of caught up with their day-to-day and activities and also the old beaten path. Mm-hmm. Instead of necessarily seeing things maybe from a lateral point of view or a little bit of thinking on the other side of the brain, but that's a problem. However, yes, you the idea will resonate very well with the likes of you and me, but not necessarily the people that they can fund it, and right. They may be brave enough to be able to pitch it and bring it into play. So. It is difficult. There are definitely loads of huge good ideas, and the ACOS in Europe last year. There were so many. I like you. I sat there going, God, these guys are amazing. Where do they get all these ideas from?
Right. No, absolutely.
You know, makes you wonder. What are they eating for breakfast? And some of these things is so obvious. You know, you go, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. You know, it's so simple. Why didn't anybody else think of it before? So there's some really good work coming out of places like Spain. I've been pretty impressed with some of the developments there, and actually throughout the world in Israel and other countries. It's there's some places that are very good at fueling this creativity.
Right, and incubating something from an idea, and then blossoming it out something bigger.
And they've got the magic of sitting in some infertile ground. You know that what makes it fertile: the bit of money, the brain power surrounding them, mm-hmm. to toss ideas with, and there's also this can-do attitude. Yes, you don't have to have anybody hold your hand; it can be done, mm-hmm. and just get on with it. That's me speculating as to how these little microcosms of and these little groups are able to come up with such innovation. It is fantastic and something that smart governments should take a good look at and encourage the same. India, amazing. What's going on in India right now is phenomenal in terms of development and growth and innovation, and they've been copying like everybody else, but now they're moving into their own, in on their own now in terms of development ideas.
Absolutely. I just got back from a meeting in Hyderabad, a cataract meeting in November, and I learned so much. I had 6 pages of notes from the lectures. Yeah, and then I'm going back to India again for the AIOS meeting in March. Yeah. And I have an incredible time there. I learned so much.
Yeah. I remember going to AIOS in 1994. It was in Bombay, but 1995. It was really rudimentary. I mean, it was really basic. Now,
it's amazing.
It's squirm. You know, we talk about 5, 10, 15 cases, and they talk about 500.
Right.
There's no comparison.
Well, they're starting to do 500 cases in a week.
Yeah. It's incredible.
So it's amazing. But I think, listen, if you get this incubator started, an ophthalmology incubator, mm-hmm. boy, I'm going to be one of your first clients. I got so much cooking on right here. I just kind of need help kind of getting it down the road a little bit.
No, I'm not sure I've got all the answers to anything, but with Infinite Medical Ventures, which is what we call ourselves, we want a board of individuals who are able to, with many talents, who are able to help us get things through. So one of the individuals we have is a gamer, is a gaming software developer, because what we're using is gaming technology. And we have an optical scientist from Turkey, but he worked for the UK Space Agency. Now he's moved on to a group that are dealing with heads up displays in cars. So, so you can look up, you're looking up in your windscreen, you've got all the information on instead of looking down at the dashboard. So sure. He's involved in that side of things, but he was with the UK Space Agency. So he was an optical guy. And then we have a patient of mine who builds cars for Red Bull, Formula One.
Oh, wow.
Doing the engineering side. So he does aerospace, medical, less so, but he's got going with us now, and he does Formula One. And he's a great guy to have on board. Everything is
right.
Can be done. So those are the groups that we've got involved at the moment. But we're looking for more. I'd love to have people who can advise us on intellectual property, others sure. who can advise us on finance and getting seed money and so on. But bit by bit, we're adding them on. And hopefully we'll have a good enough incubator to be able to handle some of the projects that you have great ideas about and others have.
I have no doubt. I mean, often, as you know, probably the most important thing is the team you build.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a great team of great people, believe me, you'll figure anything else out. You can always hire some extra expertise. And just having the team behind you, I think, is what you need to get that project to fruition.
Yeah, you can't do it on your own. You've got to fund and everything. I mean, I remember right early on, 3 years ago, thinking, oh, yeah, so they use Python to program these things. Well, so I bought a book on Python, thinking I could learn. I took one look at it, like, forget it. You can't teach an old dog new tricks here, you know? I'm going to outsource that one for sure.
Right.
I was a bit deluded. I thought maybe I could do it. Be like, well, I'm fairly good in terms of computer skills. I write databases and so on. But when it comes to programming and coding, that's where I draw the line. hand over to somebody else. It's just too time consuming. I just couldn't do it.
Well, it gets back to our original idea, but if you can delegate the task,
that's right.
Someone who's better, you should probably delegate it.
Yeah, outsource. That's a good. The thing is also, one of the things, you do still need to know what can be done to be able to convey that to the person who's going to be doing it. So sometimes you don't need to know how to do it, but you need to know what it's capable of doing. And I found that, I'm sure you found that too. You have in your mind what you want, but can it be accomplished through this process, and then take it from there. Having some knowledge of what the language can do and what the coding can do, then yes, we talk to our programmers like, this is what I'd like to do. How would you do it? And we know it can be done. And he goes, yeah, let me have a think about that. And then gets back to me and goes, yeah, I figured out how we can do it. I played around a little bit. What do you think of this? Go, wow, it's exactly what we wanted. So,
right.
So they're good. They're quick. But I think you need to know what can be achieved. The sort of cross-fertilization, knowing what other people do, not necessarily doing what they do, but knowing what they do, you can end up making phenomenal progress. So, the Buddhists talk about knowing having a good understanding about the careers of others, about the professions of others. Not that you want to do it, just knowing it is very, very useful. You understand them and you understand how to make progress too.
No, that's all the very valid points, of course. So if we have a listener right now who says, I have such an incredible idea. I've been thinking about this, working on this for a while. I think it's going to change ophthalmology. I think it's going to be incredibly successful. What's the advice you'd give them? Like the first thing you'd say, secure your intellectual property first. But then what advice would you give them to take this idea to fruition along the path? I mean, there are many steps, but what would you give it as advice?
Well, I think that securing that IP is very important by documenting it and having it. Bam! There are some who say, you know, take your notebook, write it all out, have it stamped by a lawyer, so it's established. You've done it. You've established it. And then you need to find a way to formalize that process even further on an official basis, whether it's a filing a patent or whatever. That's really hard work. We found to our chagrin, and we're now on our third patent lawyers trying to sort things out. And it turns out that, you know, and everybody's got all these lawyers got different views, but they have to understand what you want to do too. Trying to do it yourself is really hard work. Going through all the patents and doing that search, it involves a lot of money. And I think the key is to find partners you can trust, who can work with, and then very carefully with non-disclosure agreements that are fairly robust. Start talking to those whom you trust, and try to move things forward. But it really depends on the type of project it is. And there are some that are straightforward and don't require much in the way of resource. But individuals with expertise. But then there are others that are so complicated, you need a whole bunch of different individuals. So I think you need to figure out what it is, what that endpoint is, and what sort of talent you require. Because the more talent you require, the more expensive it's going to be. And is it, that's again, the viability of it. Is it viable? It may be the best idea in the world, but it may not be commercially viable if it's going to be too costly to get to the endpoint, which means it's going to be costly to the end user and so on. But I think that's where, I mean, we've learned this the hard way. We also found that Tom and myself fell into it, but quite by chance. We started working with another group, and then it just didn't work out. So we looked at each other. Well, actually, you know, we could do this ourselves, and off we went. Before we knew it, we were well on the journey with a lot of hiccups, you know, two steps forward and sometimes three backwards, and then forward, and it just goes on like that. But what I found was the point we made earlier on is having good people to communicate with who can advise and guide is key. And that's really hard to find those individuals, which is why that having that network is useful. How did I find the people that I worked with? I mean, I went on these sites that hire experts, and LinkedIn was a great one.
Sure.
I was quite impressed with whom I found on LinkedIn. Most of them didn't answer, but there were ones that did. And we developed alliances as a result of communication on LinkedIn. But then there have been others that have advised in terms of money and how to raise money and so on, although we've not raised any money at all, but just in terms of guidance. It's a difficult one. A lot depends on the project.
Right. For me, I mean, personally, I'm involved with a company where we got some patents finally issued, but it was a almost 10-year process.
Yeah, that's how long it takes. It's amazing.
And you're just like, wait a minute. And then they say, oh, don't forget, now that we have the U.S. patents, we must do the international patents.
Yeah.
So, boy, I mean, the cost, we severely underestimated the amount of time it would take, as well as the cost it's going to require to accomplish these things. But now I think, well, I'm very happy in this position. But wow.
No, and that's the other thing. That's another good message you just relayed there. Is you need deep pockets to be able to do it, or you need somebody who has deep pockets who believes in you and is willing to spend that kind of money. You can't be greedy. You're not going to accomplish it without a team, everybody has got to have a bit of consideration in terms of making a project fly. Otherwise, it just won't.
Yeah, I mean, in retrospect, I would have gladly traded a percentage of stock ownership in the company to someone else to help kind of take on this burden of work and time and money.
That's right.
I think, listen, to get an equator, an incubator of that nature, which is very common, like in Silicon Valley.
That's right.
But it's rare in ophthalmology. You're the only one I know about.
Well, we're not really established yet. We're in the process of doing it. This is what our aspiration is. And
I love it.
And hopefully we will get there. But it is a difficult one. I mean, but surely in California you got lots of ophthalmic incubators and.
No, they do. Yeah, there are other people who are doing this as well. Everyone has a great idea, but I think what you said earlier is very important. We got to capitalize on what's the future going to be. It's going to be that augmented reality when we're operating. You can see things. You know, the thing is happening. It's going to be newer technologies, maybe in a accommodating lens. It's going to be robotic cataract surgery. Oh, that's going to be huge. So there's so many things that are in development, but I can imagine the way we operate in the future. It's going to be very different.
And triaging patients, AI is going to be a huge one. So it's all imaging and accurate imaging and so on, and lots of data, and organizing the data so it can be worked on. So starting off properly is going to be key. But again, you know, so the other thing that I've also found is that a lot of people do it for money, right?
Right.
I mean, I think that's probably the wrong motivator. It is a motivator, but really it's about having impact. So, you know, if you feel that your idea is going to make a dent in the world of ophthalmology or whatever area you're involved in, and you become passionate about it, you want to have that impact. So it's more about the impact than it is about getting the revenue in, and you've got to make sure you can make ends meet. But it's not about, you know, can you sell the company for, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars or whatever. It's really about, you know, we're going to make a change. And that, I think, is the biggest motivating factor. So for Tom and myself, you know, we're going to be disruptive. We want to change how everybody examines patients. We want to change how we work in ophthalmology. And that really motivates us. And we feel we can do it, but it has to be affordable. And it has to be, you know, it meets all these criteria. We go, wait a minute. Affordability. How are we going to do that then? And so on. And it becomes the critique for yourself. How are you going to accomplish? You need to know what you want to accomplish and why. And then how are you going to go about doing that? So that's been our journey so far. As I said, we're still at the stage where we need to get out there and get something going. I'm hoping that there's a lot of work involved. I'm just hoping that a bigger company will work in alliance with us. And take away some of the noise so we can concentrate on innovation and development. And it looks like it, I mean, there's certainly been of interest to several. And we're talking, and hopefully we'll make progress.
But I think you're right. It has to be your passion, and you have to look to kind of really innovate and kind of change the face of what we're doing now.
That's right.
As opposed to chasing the dollar. Because importantly, as smart as ophthalmologists are, if you took that ophthalmology brain power and applied it to investment banking, you would be far richer than doing eye surgery.
Yeah, all those years as well, decades.
Right.
It'd be several fold over, right? So and I think what a lot of people look sideways and look over their shoulders and see what others are doing. Forget all that. Just you got to do what's right for you yourself.
Right.
And you can recognize it in the people that accomplish. Right. They're sort of kind of single-minded. They know what it is they want to try and achieve, and they just they're like a Jack Russell with a dog in their mouth. They're not going to let go.
And, right, they compete with themselves. They're not competing with each other.
No, that's right. Exactly. You gotta forget about everybody else. It's you. You're working on yourself. And I've just my observation, seeing those guys that managed to do it, they're clearly very passionate, and it's almost like every waking moment, you're consumed by the issue. Well, you know, if you're putting that much energy into it.
You're gonna win.
You're bound to succeed.
No, absolutely. Yeah, with that much passion in it, you have to succeed. You know, same with when I did cataract coaches. You know, I have an idea. I want to make a video every day. And then it's like, wow, 2,000 some days later, I'm still doing it.
Well, incredible.
So it's not about like the one flash in the pan success. It's about like I grind every day.
Yeah. Now, how long does it take you? give away your trade secrets here.
It is
a video a day. I mean, what's
generally, you can the length of the video times 10 is the amount of work.
I know.
So 5 minute, 6 minute video is about an hour of work if you're very good at it. Mm-hmm. If you've not really edited a whole lot of videos before, that one video can take you many hours.
Yeah, an hour a minute.
Yeah, it can be right. Instead of 10x, it can be 60x amount of time. It can take a lot of time. Yeah. So I've obviously gotten very, very good at it. I've created templates for my thing. I've kind of branded it too. I have an intro sound. I have a logo. But I always use the same fonts, the same font color. I always have the same format. And I've automated as much as I can with these templates and things of this nature. But even then, every video I make, I have to do a voiceover. I've learned to do essentially 98% of the time, I do the voiceover in one take. There's no editing of But I mean, this is 2,000 videos later. So, I mean, I got pretty good at it.
Yeah,
but you're right. But it's just about being passionate about it.
I didn't do it. You always succeed. I didn't do it often enough. I go, oh, God, how did I do that again on Final Cut? And I go back to the YouTube videos going, oh, yeah. So, oh, that takes time. You know, oh, yeah, I remember that now. And I go off and do it. But if you're doing it all the time, I suppose you get to be pretty swift at it. So for me, it's maybe I'll leave that for another day. And then it doesn't happen, which is a problem. But I'm finding actually just taking excerpts of videos is great. And I'm doing a bit more of that. So just taking little snippets. A little vignettes that help convey a message. But yeah, it's amazing what you can do with video. It's you take scraps of all sorts of things and create a wonderful story. And you do it really well.
Yeah, it's also very different depending on the generation. So I'll have comments from ophthalmologists who are, let's say, further on in their careers, at the end of their careers. And they say, well, can you show the whole video? Can you show it in real time? Whereas the very young ophthalmologists in their 30s or 40s, they are always watching it at least in 2x speed, and they just want to get right to it. I mean, if you look at like the way video shifted, even now people watch videos on Instagram or TikTok, which are like very, very brief. Everything's sped up. They don't want to. No one wants to watch it in real time anymore.
Well, the attention span is very, very short, right? So
it's tough.
That is the problem. I see it with my own kids. They got several things going on at one time, and then what are you actually watching? Well, everything, but you're not really watching it. No, but there are bits here that take my interest, and then I might switch over and when that's interesting, you know, really? But when they were younger, they would sit there, they'd go on FaceTime with their friends, they'd be in front of the computer, and they'd have a textbook open.
Right, all at the same time.
All at the same time. It's different generational altogether.
I think the younger generation, their brains are way more capable than mine.
No, I think they are. And certainly what they learn in medical school now, gosh, I don't think I would have got through medical school in terms of what they have in the curriculum. It's phenomenal, the knowledge that they have to accumulate. Wow.
Well, they learned everything we learned 30 years ago. And then on top of that, all the developments in the last 30 years, they learned that too in the same amount of time.
No. So I sent her to Olivia today, so she's revising. So I said, well, Olivia, I've never seen you with a textbook. Oh, we don't use those anymore. So how do you revise? It's all online. There's all these, you know, I'm not sure I could do that to revise without a
right.
Book. You know, the old style. Yeah, I could pick up information, but I'd like to see progress. I'm getting for that darn book, and I know when I'm coming to the end. Looking at a Kindle or an iPad, I'm not sure I'm getting to the end until I look at the little bar that tells me how close I am. But yes, it's wired up differently.
Well, but you know, I think we have to embrace that. So even me, my latest cataract surgery book about how to learn cataract surgery, it's very basic. It's meant for very young surgeons or surgeons in training. It's a free PDF file as a book.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's not a physical book. You go to my website, you click on it, you can download it, you can put it on your phone, on your iPad, on your laptop, send it to your friends, and just enjoy it. It's all there. So it's...
Right, you're enlightened.
The neat part, too, though, if you didn't have the past, if you had it as a physical book on your desk, well, you can't hit play for the video.
No.
They can read your book and hit play and watch the video of it.
Yeah. No, that integrated media format is fantastic. So, yeah, with Olivia, when she started at medical school, They gave her an iPad. And
yeah.
they gave them a new iPad because it's the old one's, you know, the bigger one with and the, all their schedules and everything gets ported across to their calendars, and it's incredible. There's not enough room in the lecture halls for everybody, so they webcast the lectures. So
wow.
If she's making time, she can sit outside or she can sit in a cafe, Starbucks, and watch the lecture take place. Unheard of in our time. I mean, this is that has changed.
Brilliant. In the old days, we had to take notes during a lecture.
Yeah. And then if you weren't there, you'd have to borrow somebody's books, right?
Right. Now you can just play back the lecture anytime you want.
Yeah.
No, it's amazing. No, I think to sum all this up, I think there's so much change in ophthalmology. It's so good. It's really going to advance our field. Clearly, the way we're going to operate in 10 years is not the way we're doing it now. We'll have amazing techniques and technologies. And I encourage all our listeners, all our viewers, please get involved. If you have a great idea, run with it. And make sure, like you said, two things. Number one, you're passionate about it. And number two, it's going to have that big impact in our field. And if that's the case, you should absolutely pursue it.
Go for it. As Waldo Emerson says, you have an idea, the universe conspires to make it happen. If it's a good idea and you're really passionate about it, it just happens. And there's some sort of magic out there that helps that take place. I just believe it. It's amazing. If it's the right thing, and you, as you say, passionate,
it'll always take
it. Things work out. And it's that magic. I don't know what it is, but it's out there. And I'd love to keep tapping into it if I can. While they still let me.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Shiraz, you've had an amazing journey in ophthalmology. I mean, truly fascinating.
I'm not done yet.
No, I'm just saying, amazing journey so far.
Yeah.
But like, I'm just so excited about your next chapter. I think you've got, I love how you're changing gears a little bit and saying, okay, the next chapter, I'm going to focus on this. I think that's just brilliant. And I think that's what we should all think about.
Well, I hope it works.
Oh, with you at the helm, there's no doubt.
You know, as we start our careers, we start off sort of gradually, and then it starts going exponentially, and then it sort of plateaus out.
Right.
The key thing is when you're starting to plateau out, to find something else, because then you have a bit of time that starts that gentle journey, because then that will eventually go exponentially, right?
Right.
You have something to replace whatever you leave behind. And yeah, that's the way I see it. It happens in everything. You get to a point where, okay, there's not much more you can do. And either you're getting too old for it, or you're getting tired of it, or some other young Turk has taken over. And then you find something else to do. And I think it's important for all colleagues to consider, you know, what next in terms of your own development, and what are you going to do for yourself and on this journey that we have on this planet.
Right.
I think it's very important also to keep ourselves occupied. I've got a 93-year-old father who runs a pharmaceutical industry still. We're trying to sell it, but he's 93. And, Asian genes, they're not always the most brilliant. They do get, but he's done really well. He's got him out of bed. He's completely on the ball. The physical body is not fantastic, but his mind is there. It's he's got this old Gujarati brain that figures things out very, very quickly. How has he kept it up? Because he goes to work every morning. That gets him out of bed. I think that's important for all of us. We need to keep our brains going.
Right. You have to have a purpose. And I think it's really important. Once you're starting to get stagnant,
mm-hmm.
and you're not learning and growing and whatever, you need to change gears a little bit. You can stay in ophthalmology like we all do,
mm-hmm.
but a different aspect of it. And initially, some of the changes I've had in the past, when they happened, I saw them as a bad thing. But then it was only in retrospect, like, you know what? That turned out to be a blessing in disguise. It was the best thing ever.
It's funny how when you're young, you're more, and sometimes at times you think you'd be embrace things, but you're more hesitant.
Right.
But yeah, as you mature along, you realize that there's a lot of new things out there that you don't know the thing that we're going to keep and what we're not going to keep, right? It's very hard. And I remember Dick Lindstrom saying, all I can say is this is what we do today. and 50% of what I do today is probably going to be medieval or rubbish in about 5 years. And he's got a point there, right? I mean, change happens.
I had an amazing time talking to Shiraz. I'm like so motivated. I want to get up and like start writing down new ideas and start. You're a brilliant guy. Love having you as a close friend in ophthalmology. Learned so much from you. I'm going to put some links down below for your meeting you have coming up with Dr. Peronis and whatever other links you want to share with us. But again, thank you so much for doing this podcast. What an inspiration you are. I'm really blessed.
Well, we're all flocking together, right? It's great. I've watched you in great admiration, and we've talked about it with Cataract Coach and others. Great energy. And we'd all like to be like you too, Uday.
All right, fantastic. So for our viewers, remember, we got a new podcast every single week. Be sure to check it out on Amazon, Apple, Spotify, Google, anywhere you find your podcast, obviously on YouTube and Cataract Coach as well. And then the links are going to be down below. And then we will catch you next time for another amazing podcast.